Alrighty, and now it gives me great pleasure to announce our speaker for the evening, Billy from Santa Maria.
My name is Billy. I'm an alcoholic.
Billy.
Jesse.
Oh, sorry, Billy.
No. Reminded him last week because he does the third Saturday meeting, and it's a good for the speaker to not have a binder in front of him.
Thank you, Billy.
You're welcome. This is being recorded. It'll be at central office probably 15 minutes after I finish. No. No, sometime in the next week or so. I haven't gotten your talk to Ron yet, Bob. But it will be getting up there.
I've been writing about it.
Huh? Yes. No. Yes. And this is my phone on vibrate. Kevin D couldn't be here. He's a Thursday night secretary, and he said he'd be here in spirit. And I said, well, feel free to call. I probably won't answer it. But so Kevin might be popping in. And I want to echo what Leola says. You know, I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you hear me okay back there?
Louder. Turn it up.
I love Alcoholics Anonymous, owe my life to it. I washed up on the shores here 2 weeks after I got sober. I got sober at a therapist's office, or on the day I saw a therapist, October 2nd, 1984, and October 16th, I washed up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous. And getting here, I knew alcoholism was a disease, it's progressive, and I have it. And I was pretty sure that people at Alcoholics Anonymous knew how to stay sober. And that's what I wanted to do. And I was totally on board with it. I had 2 weeks under my belt. When I first got sober, I was staying sober a week at a time. And that's how it came to be. And so I'm going to talk about love a few times here. And Garrett, it's just so cool to see you here still, you know, and each one of you. Charles, that was a really good share yesterday or the day before, and other times too, but there was one from the bottom of your heart in the last 48 hours that I heard you share that was really spot on. And Janet, you know, good to be sitting with you at a meal. And here with us, and this is a really safe place. And I'm going to talk about love a few times, or mention it a few times, or whatever, and to have a good sense of the love that's in this room, and not just the love that's in this room, but the love that's outside of this room, and the opportunity that life affords. An alcoholic that's wasted out of his mind. I'm going to ask for help with this.
Yes, that's a good service.
Yeah.
You're very ethical.
If we need some more cards, I printed a bunch. In the course of sobriety, I was a couple years sober, and a friend of mine gave me that photograph. And threw it inside my as-built, sees it. And years later, I learned how to use a computer. A few years later, I learned how to do graphics. And up until that time, my card was just, you know, one day at a time, Billy Ann, and my phone number. And my higher power said, you know, put that picture on a card and put a little message there for the newcomer that's dashing out of the room. And so I did. And I've gotten a lot of direction over the years from my higher power like that. And it might not be obvious to you already. Well, let me back up. In the course of my drinking, I did some like psychedelics and stuff like that, and some inhalant stuff that really fried my brain. There was a point where I forgot my name. I had to ask somebody, what's my name? And there was a point I was going to a really dark place. And going into that really dark place, it was like a one-way trip to nowhere. And I would have been in an institution sucking my thumb for the rest of my heartbeats. And I don't use the F-bomb when I share, but I use the J-word a few times. And I was going into that really dark place, and I cried out the name of my higher power when I was a child. I grew up in, I had four sisters on the day I was born, eight by the time I was 6 years old. And my brother came along when I was 8 years old, and it was a big Catholic family, and the name of my higher power growing up was Jesus. And I was going into this totally dark, dark place, one-way trip to nowhere, and I called out, Jesus, help me. And I was in the middle of my drinking days. It didn't get me sober or anything, but I came out of it. And it's an indelible experience that I had. And I say that to excuse myself for having a disjointed pitch, okay? My brain was like totally scrambled at one time. It's been a long road of recovery and rehabilitation and showing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was 4 months sober, I got railroaded to be in the secretary and of the men's stag. That was my home group. And speaking of the men's stag, that was my home group. I had a brother-in-law that had invited me to Alcoholics Anonymous over the years many times. His name was George Price. And I have his 30-year chip. And he died 8 years ago, something like that. But anyhow, I got taken to the men's stag after seeing this therapist for a couple of weeks. And she recommended it, and I was ready. And he took me, and 4 months later, I was the secretary. It was in the church library in Santa Barbara, the Episcopal Church on the corner of Mitchell Terrain and the State, like a big Gothic church with a big hardwood panel library and all this stuff. And it was a smoking meeting. I don't know how they got away with it. When I became secretary, we didn't change it to be non-smoking. I was smoking too. But I set it up so there's fans at the windows, because before that it was just smoke, and I could only imagine what the parish pastor or whatever would be thinking about the Tuesday stag. Anyhow, while I'm into my pockets here, I'm going to show you the basic 12-step kit, which those of you who know, you know, and if you don't know, you don't know, pen and paper. Although I have to say this dates me, because now you just changed numbers on a cell phone. But anyhow, this is a 12-step kit in my book, but changing numbers on smartphones works really well too. But anyhow, so my point in all that preface is I don't have a canned talk. I don't talk very often, okay? So my talk is in a yogurt basket. Okay? I had so many things pop into mind in the last few weeks. I totally don't want to miss one. Thanking my higher power, inviting my higher power in right here, right now, to guide me to share the message of hope, of freedom, of joy, of peace, of trials, tribulations, challenges, growth, you know, learning to do things you never thought you could possibly do. A friend over there is going to be getting a tricycle one of these days, and or a three-wheeled bicycle, excuse me, with gears to change the gears. And anyhow, it was a really good talk. This is, by the way, I'm going to take one little pot shot at, no, am I, no, yes, no, okay, yes. This is laid out like a spreadsheet, and it has three columns, and you put it like that, it has like 10 or 12 columns, and people that do spreadsheets can do that, so if, anyhow, okay, I'm sorry, I digress. I need to mostly stay focused for the benefit of the newcomers that are here, because if I'm just goofing around and some guy who's half brain dead was sharing the message of hopelessness and disorientation and spaciness and so on, after 34 years it wouldn't be real attractive. But I did make a few notes. I'm not sure if I already said it. I want to thank Daniel for asking me to lead. He couldn't be here tonight. I want to thank Jesse for being the secretary, standing in for Daniel. And I want to thank Lee for putting together we got together and had a meal. Janet was there, and Cindy and Bob and Aaron and Chris and Kathy and...
Don. He went to the church, though.
And Don. Okay, yeah. Anyhow, and Brian. And that was really cool. So I want to congratulate Philip on your birthday. 3 years, that's really cool. And welcome the newcomers, Garrett and Charles and Janet. And so before I get much into my story, I want to introduce Alcoholics Anonymous. What my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was like, because had it been different, I might not have stayed. And the first thing that really locked me in here was the third tradition. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And if there's anyone in the room that has dual things going on, I had a guy one time, I was his temporary sponsor, and he didn't feel like he could go to AA because he didn't want to lie. He didn't want to say he was an alcoholic. And I made it clear to him, we don't want you to lie. If you don't know if you're an alcoholic, that's fine. The requirement for membership is a desire to not drink. And if drinking takes you to other things, you just don't want to go there, then you're welcome. So that third tradition really opened the door wide for me. And in a few different pieces in the big book that have helped me enormously, give me direction, is there's a sentence in here, the point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines, and we read it every time Chapter 5 is shared at a meeting. And toward the back of the big book, when they wrote the big book, they wrote it for the solitary alcoholic that's out there in the boondocks. There was no Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no meeting directories, there was no court cards. And also, by the way, I want to welcome Jim's couple of daughters, and that's not all of them, but the two that were able to come. And I want to, and that's Olivia and Alexis, and I want to welcome Ann, Gil's wife, and the rest of you looking around, all I see is my brothers and sisters. Oh, and Katie.
I'm also new to the meeting.
Pardon?
I said I'm also new to the meeting here.
Okay. Robert?
Robert.
Right on, Robert. Welcome.
Yeah.
Cool. And welcome, Jackson.
Roger's my friend.
Okay. Right on, Robert. You got a good friend there. Yeah. So, let's try and move this a little, not you, but me. Wait a second. Okay, so anyhow, so the big book, the first 164 pages in the doctor's opinion, and this is a copy of the big book, and we have copies up here, and I've got a copy in my car that I can donate.
I have a copy.
You have a copy, great, cool. Anyhow, there's a line in here towards the end of A Vision for You, and it says, thus we grow, and so can you, though you be but one man with this book in your hand. We believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin. And what Alcoholics Anonymous is, what getting sober is the beginning of something. And without having a beginning here, we don't get the life that's here. And on the next page, it says our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. And the fact that it said that, they read A Vision for You at the end of lots of meetings, and it expresses a level of humility rather than saying, we know it all, this is it, do it or die. That would be like, well, I think I'll go somewhere else or whatever. But where it says, here's what we know so far. We're trying to help you get your feet on the ground in a spiritual life. And we realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. That opens the door to me. It's like when I when Daniel asked me to lead, and I wanted to emphasize that we realize we know only a little, and God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. I happened to look at the April 27th in there, and it's joyful discoveries. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day, and so on. And it was like, that's cool. I'm really glad that that was there. There's a piece in here, Garrett. Are you with me, Garrett? This, by the way? Cool. At the beginning of chapter 2, it talks about a powerful cement. And we're like passengers on a shipwreck. And we've survived this shipwreck. And there's camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from the captain's table to the steerage, where the workers are. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us. Having a common peril, we could be down a local bar and have a common peril. We could be at Vaughn's in the ice cream section having a common peril. But we could be anywhere, drinking or getting wasted, and we all have a common peril. But the powerful cement that binds us is the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. And then last, at the back of this big book, there's a thing called the spiritual appendix. And this was really important for me to see or for me to hear and to read and to understand. On the wall back there, it says honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. Like, that's how we do it. And in the big book, it says willingness. So we find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. And I always like to point out that willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness spells who. And if you want to be who you are, be who there is for you to be in sobriety. It starts with willingness. I had willingness before I had a whole lot of capacity for honesty. And anyhow, so I'd like to just point that out. And then there's a principle, which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. And that principle is contempt prior to investigation. And and I'm going to leave the rest of this for my yogurt can fit. Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Those are, to me, the book is full of key things that are like essentials or that are.
Reference points for me. Am I willing to grow along spiritual lines at all times? Am I growing along spiritual lines? No. If I sit down with a carton of ice cream, I've kind of put the pause button on my willingness to grow along spiritual lines. Because when I sit down with a carton of ice cream, I eat the whole thing. And there's one other thing I wanted to throw out here. Is like, I'm here, right here, right now, because if I have a drink, a craving's going to kick in. If this is Jack Daniels, all of a sudden that's all I'm going to be thinking about. And that's a common thing that we all have in this room. Now, having I call it a physical condition. If I have a condition that a craving's going to kick in, if I start on a carton of ice cream and I get it up to 253 pounds, and my blood pressure is 200/100, and my sisters are kind of like, are you going to live or are you going to die, and so on. that's a condition that I have. And so, but with alcohol, it's just a condition that I have. It's not to be guilty. It's not to be ashamed. Alcoholism is not caused by character defects. If alcoholism was caused because you're a funky person, then all you've got to do is become a cool person, a good person, a warm-hearted person, a loving person, caring person, and have a drink or two to celebrate. You know, as simple as that. So breaking it down that way, to me, just it's a condition I have. It's like if I had five fingers, I do. If I had six fingers, and as a welder, I need a special glove. I could do trick things that a welder with five fingers couldn't do, I'm sure. But it would not be a defect. It's a condition. It's just how it is. It's how I am. And so having a condition like that, that a craving kicks in if I drink, and having pitiful and incomprehensible and demoralizing experiences, like if I drink, it's more than a condition that kicks in. It's more than a craving kicks in. It's that I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of alcohol. There's on the step up there, steps up there, there's a third step. You know, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand God. And that a lot of people rebel at. I'm not turning my will and my life over to care of nothing, you know. I'm just not turning my will and my life over. And the reality is that every time I drank, I turned my will and my life over. Every time I took something or smoked something or whatever, I turned my will and my life over to care of it. So I want to open that door really wide. All of us have turned our will and our lives over the care of fill in the blank many times. So here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we turn our will and life over the care of a power greater than ourselves. We turn our will and lives over the care of the unknown, unseen source of whatever's good, and so on. Having a condition like that, I ignored my condition. In my thinking, I allowed myself to say, I'm only going to have two, or I'm only hurting myself, or I'm just going to this, I'm just going to that, whatever. Whatever I would tell myself that I'd say yes to that allowed me to have a drink, that's insane because of where alcohol takes me. And I like to throw that out there just because it leads into the second step. You know, the alcoholic condition is a condition. There's nothing we can do about it. If alcoholic thinking was a condition, there never would have been Alcoholics Anonymous. There is Alcoholics Anonymous because there was alcoholic thinking is not a condition, it's a problem. And it becomes a problem. Anything that any problem anyone ever had, has now, or ever will have, what makes a problem is the fact that there's a solution. And there is a solution to alcoholic thinking, and it's here in Alcoholics Anonymous is doing the 12 steps. And but alcoholic thinking is insane. Where alcohol takes me to not take care of my alcoholic thinking, that's crazy. And so that leads us right into the second step. Came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, if Bill Wilson could have fixed his alcoholic thinking on his own power, he just decided, you know, that's it, that's far enough, I'm not drinking anymore, I'm going to pray night and day, and that's going to be it, and I have no more thoughts about drinking. And he prays night and day, and he has no more thoughts about drinking, and he's a free man, he's free from alcohol. And there never would have been Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous came to life because of the path that Bill Wilson was on, because of the path that other people were on that I don't know about, because of the path that Dr. Bob was on. And so my point is that there is a solution to alcoholic thinking. If you're having a craving or you're having an obsession or you're having a whatever, you don't have to go where that goes. You don't have to go where that takes you. And we have the solution here. And we do it one day at a time. I was 20-some days sober, and that really heavy idea came to mind, like, you can never, ever drink again. If I want to have a life, I can never, ever drink again. And it's like, that's a heavy idea. And two things came to mind. One was, that's why it's one day at a time. And the other thing that came to mind was, I can't say I can't do it. And so if your sobriety day is like April 22nd or something, you can't say you can't do it. And anyhow, but I do want to share that not all of this in the big book applies to me. And I want to share that because I want to open the door as wide as I can for an alcoholic to get in this room, be in this room, and stay in this room. And I'm sure some people would look at it and say, that doesn't apply, that doesn't apply, that doesn't apply, so I must not be an alcoholic, or I'm not an alcoholic yet. And the reality is, I mean, I was too spaced out to even recognize that some of these things don't apply to me when I was early in sobriety. But along the way, I did recognize it. And just recently, I'm going to, line by line, on the first couple paragraphs of Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And with reference to the fact that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. In the big book, it says somewhere is that we are always more or less insanely drunk. And I wasn't always more or less insanely drunk. I swore it off every morning. Later in the day, I got started. And whenever I got started, the liquor store was a half block away. My life was a little small circle from the liquor store to my studio where I lived and did my work. Or sometimes I was doing well and I had an apartment there, like in a 3 or 4 block radius. That was my life. And anyhow, so I wasn't always more or less insanely drunk, but it was insane that I ever drank because I wasn't living my life. I wasn't having a life. So it says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. Okay, now I identify with that. To me, what makes a real alcoholic is the fact that a craving kicks in if I drink. No person likes to think he's bodily and mentally different from his fellows. I remember when I was sitting on a rock, it was like a Saturday, except I don't know if it was a Saturday, because like every day was a Saturday back in those days. But I was sitting on a rock and it crossed my mind that I'm an alcoholic. And I had no sense of alarm, no sense of catastrophe awaits, or no sense of not even living my life. It explained why I wasn't living my life, explained why I didn't have a life. I wasn't thinking like I'm bodily and mentally different than anyone else. I just wasn't thinking. Therefore, it's not surprising our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. I got sober when I was 26. I was living in my car. I got a drunk driving. I got into a recovery house. I got a job. The 4th of July came up. I was dotting my I's and crossing my T's at the recovery house, but I wasn't plugged into sobriety. And like my roommate offered me pot, and I said, no, I'm staying sober. I'm staying clean. But I wasn't plugged into the steps. I wasn't plugged into like I need to stay sober or anything. I was just living in a recovery house instead of living in my car. And I got a job, and the 4th of July came up, and the whole house went to the AA picnic. And I went to the company picnic, and I hadn't drank for 6 or 8 weeks, so I knew a couple of beers wouldn't hurt me none. And 9 years went by. I never tried. People that struggle here that get sobriety and cash it in and get it and cash it in and all that stuff, I feel for you. But on the other hand, feel for me. It's like... If you want what I have, the first thing is get 6 or 8 weeks sober, then cash it in, let 9 years go by. And if you survive it, by the end of it, when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll be ready to stay. And that's how it was for me. So I, not going to, well, maybe one or two more lines, whatever. The point here is that it's important that we identify with our alcoholism. We identify what applies to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. And don't worry about what doesn't apply. Okay? So, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a secretary for the men's stag when I was 4 months sober. I had a couple of different commitments here and there. My brother-in-law took me to the jail when I was 2 years sober. Saw Lynn there probably when I was 3 or 4 years sober. She should be going to the jail, and I'd be leaving the jail doing H&I stuff. And anyhow, along the way, I had a long-running commitment to take meetings into the Honor Farm and into the jail. And what I'm sharing now, you know, like my story, you know, pictures worth 1,000 words. And I grew up with an unshakable, unbreakable love of God. And by the end of the drinking days, I had disdain for God if there was a God. And that's what my path was in my alcoholism. And we all have that path, not that path, but we all have our path that brought us here. We all have our path in our alcoholism. We all have our path of going where alcohol takes us. Okay, but to me, I want to share where Alcoholics Anonymous has taken me, where my recovery has gone. Saying yes when my higher power puts things in front of me. And anyhow, so I was doing the honor farm, and I was driving by one day, and I had a sponsee at the honor farm, and it was like 10 in the morning, something like that, and I thought it'd be a good idea to stop and see if I can talk to him for a little bit. And the guards knew me really well. There's no trouble getting in. And this big guy, Chuck C., which some of you know, he was doing a class with in the men's section. And I asked if I could talk to this one guy that I sponsored. And he wasn't sure. He was kind of new there. And he went and asked this other guy, Bob T. Well, God bless Bob T. He was a Vietnam vet. And he passed away in an airplane crash 2 or 3 years ago. And but he came at me like a tiger, like I'd done something totally offensive. And in the course of the conversation, you know, I said, I've been doing this longer than you've been sober. And it wasn't really the right thing to say to someone in a position of authority, but all I did was stop by to be supportive to a sponsee and so on. When I went up the food chain, and a guy named David V, who was in charge of the STP program, he found it desirable to suspend me from bringing meetings in. And all these, I'd been going in every Sunday for years, and all these relationships that you have with these guys here got sliced off like that. And it was when the day came that the verdict was handed down, so to speak, I got this card in the mail from China. And at the end of my drinking days, what I was doing for a living was cutting rectangles of leather, sewing a zipper on, and making zipper pouches. I was doing for a living what people do in psych wards. And I wound up, eventually, came up with some products that were pretty cool, and wound up, by God's grace, I was at a trade show in Orlando, Florida, sharing a booth with a woman from New York that a sales rep from Las Vegas had hooked me up with, and I had my leather waist packs, and I needed to make them in microfiber, and the woman that I was set up with in Orlando, she was from New York, she had microfiber backpacks and briefcases. I said, can I use your manufacturer? And they said, yeah, better than that, the agent is here at the show, and I met the agent. In Hong Kong, they all have English first names as well as their Chinese names. And this woman about this tall, Yolanda Fock, and she was my agent. And so I got hooked up, and I gotta watch the clock. Holy smokes, time's flying. Well, anyhow, this is Billy's talk. That's it. So, anyhow, on the same day the hammer came down that I was suspended from the STP program, that was like so rough. You know, anyone, you know, deal with resentments or anger or stuff like around here? Which reminds me, I was in early sobriety, I'd hear people share about resentments, and it's like, you know, this is an AA meeting. Why are you talking about resentments? And it took, I mean, I didn't even know I had a resentment. I recognized my first resentment when I was 2 years sober. Now, there was stuff going on in my family that my dad was a focal point on, that we had to take action and so on and so forth, that I'm not going to get into more than that, that someone might look at as resentment, but it's more like intervention on behavior and stuff like that. But I didn't, you know, I didn't have a resentment. I was apathetic at the end of my drinking. I was just stumbling forward in life. My higher power was, I mean, I stumbled forward and generally had shelter, generally had food, generally had something I did. But it was never designed for a profession, or I need to get married, or I need to this, or I need to that. I was just blotto and out of it, and by God's grace, making a go of it. But I got this card on the day I was suspended from the STP program, and it's all these Chinese signatures. And it says, can you hear that? And I had sent them fudge. I sent them like 50 pounds of fudge. You know, that's what I do. I wanted to send them money for a Christmas bonus kind of thing if they were my own workers. But sending them money would create a upheaval because other manufacturers would not be paying them extra, so we can't take money from you. And I was able to send them $10 each. But I sent them 50 pounds of fudge by air. And that's how good things were then. But anyhow, it says, can you hear the clapping from all of us? These are parts of the signature from our workers. Some of them have been home. Hope you can join the banquet and share the joy with us one day, because they have a Christmas banquet, and I've been to it a few times since then. But anyhow, so that was a God shot. Okay. This is my mom. And when my sister-in-law died, before my mom, by this time I'm computerized, I'm doing graphics and stuff like that. My sister-in-law had ovarian cancer. And when a woman gets ovarian cancer, it's pretty much a death sentence within 6 months. Not always, but generally. And she had a six-year-old daughter. And she had surgery, and she had chemo, and she had radiation. And she got into remission. And it was 2 years later, she got in remission. And we had a barbecue at her house, and she ate solid food. She wasn't eating through a tube. And I remember Sting's Fields of Gold playing in the background, and it was so cool. And then it came back. She had surgery again, and chemo again, and radiation again. And it came back again, and she got into remission, but then it came back again, and she was too weak for surgery, and she had chemo, and she had radiation, and then she passed away. But her daughter was 11, and she went through all that to be there for her daughter. So she was there for 5 years. And I share it because in her cancer, chemo and radiation and surgery, it wasn't like, oh, I don't feel like having my chemo today. You know, alcoholism is every bit as deadly as ovarian cancer. And the idea of feeling like going to a meeting to me is just totally missing the point. Or like, I don't like that meeting. Okay, so go to that meeting. Bring sobriety. There's no sobriety at that meeting. Well, bring it. You know, bring it in the door. You know, if there's none there, say, oh, I don't go there. There's no sobriety there. No, that's where I go. When I first moved to Santa Maria, I went to the Tuesday meeting at the Alana Club. It's a cinder block room at that time. And the Lion's Den was going on. Everybody's at the Lion's Den. I'm at this Tuesday meeting. The woman running it is 6 months sober. There's a lot of people from the ASA house across the street and so on. And I'm there because I'm bringing it. And it reminded me of the Honor Farm days and stuff like that. So anyhow, when my niece died, the family supplied me with photos and copy and the obituary. And by God's grace, and in just an ocean of tears, I put together 4 pages front and back with pictures and obituary and readings from the service mixed in. And the ability to do that for the blotto guy that I was at the end of my drinking days, I became computerized because when I was 8 years sober, they needed volunteers at the central office in Santa Barbara, and I signed up for a 4-hour shift. And being there once a week, eventually there's this guy, John A., and he would be walking through, just walking in really fast, go see the manager, and walking out really fast. And he was bald, but he was like tearing his hair out. And he was the treasurer, and he'd been the treasurer for 3 years, and he was totally burned out on doing it. And God said, you know, Billy, you can do that. You know, I can count, I'm honest, and so on. So I said, I can do it. Nobody would do it. Nobody that was familiar with central office would stand for it. And so I stood for it. I assured them I'm not going to be in charge of raising money. I'm not going to be a fundraiser. But I'll keep track of it. Well, this guy that I relieved had it on a computer. And for me, up until then, computers were for people who couldn't figure things out in their head. I had the top SAT score in my high school. I was going to marry my high school sweetheart, make babies, and figure out life as you go along. Uh-huh. And the Vietnam War was going on. I graduated high school in 1967. To my surprise, this shows you how high my communication skills are. In the middle of summer, my girlfriend that I thought I was going to marry and make babies with told me she was going to Florida State to school. Her dad had gotten his PhD at UCSB, got a job at Florida State. She was going 3,000 miles away, and I had no clue she was even thinking about higher education. To me, higher education was for people who needed to be told what to think about. I had a scholarship to anywhere I wanted to go in the state based on my SAT score. And my dad, God bless him, but he was overwhelmed with this, that, and the other thing or whatever. And he didn't fill out the paperwork for the scholarship, you know, the financials for the scholarship. It was like a one-page thing. Didn't get filled out, and it's okay. When I found out, my reaction was, cool, someone else can have my spot. I don't need it. I can figure it out as I go along. So here I am using a computer. I can't do spreadsheets in my head, you know, and so on. And I learned how to make a spreadsheet. And then I got my own computer. I used my sponsor's computer after the treasurer handed off And I'm of the generation that was using Windows 3.0, and then 3.1 was a big upgrade. But anyhow, so fast forward from that, and I learned how to do graphics, and I made this like this for my niece, and then I got to make one for my mom. And some of the comments were mine. Mom growing, she had 10 children, right, in 17 years. Mom growing in spirit into the woman she was becoming. And so on. Mom turned 90. She didn't just turn 90, she turned 90 at my house. I was living in my warehouse in Santa Barbara. I came up in July of 2001 to stay with my mom overnight. Our siblings were taking turns. My dad was in the hospital. And went outside the next day, and there's a for sale sign on the house across the street. And God, my higher power, said, snag it. And I said, I'll sign for it if you pay for it. And God said, you're on, let's do it. And so I moved up here. And I got to live across the street from my parents. They were in the mid-80s. And they moved to down where my brother was in Port Hueneme in 2007. And so anyhow, her 90th birthday was in my house. And I never had a house before. And it was just really cool. And while I'm on family, there's Susan, Claudia, Kay, Sheila, me, Teresa, Mary Ann, Pauline, and Joe, my siblings. And anyhow, the punchline on this, oh yeah, icon, or not an image from Happy Feet, okay? So Happy Feet was going on in like 2006, and I went and saw it by myself, and it's like, wow, what a cool movie. I took my mom to it. She was like, she totally enjoyed it. It was like just right her age level. She was probably 91 by then. And no reference to you, Marilyn. You're like me. You're 70 like I am. But my mom was, yeah. Oops. This great examples of the room of long-term sobriety. I have like 34 years, and there's three of us that are sober longer than me. And that's really cool. And one of us is my brother in the third decade. Anyhow, so I wound up, then the sibling came up to help take care, and I took her, then I took her and my mom and my dad and so on. I saw Happy Feet 11 times. And that's it. This is from the last page of the booklet of my niece that passed away. She's in Italy, and she's looking back over her shoulder, and it's like a live thing. And showing this stuff is just about saying yes to life. I wouldn't have known how to use a computer, but saying yes to answering the phone at central office. I wouldn't have known how to talk to or listen to really difficult people, except I got to be the leader or the secretary. Do I stop at 5'2" or straight up?
Straight up, I think.
Thanks. There's a place called the Eclectic Institute in Isla Vista, and it was a landing place or an apartment building that was parolees from federal and maybe state prison, and there was an AA meeting going in there once a week, and they volunteered or railroaded me to do it. I'm probably 2 years sober at the time, maybe three, and I am not a disciplined at that time in my life. I have discipline in my life now, but I didn't get into my sponsors yet, and maybe I'll miss that. But my point is, I went in there because God put it on my radar screen. And when I was there, I got to share with these guys that I had nicotine sobriety. I was 2 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks sober when I got nicotine sobriety. So they can be talking about hard drugs, getting off hard, oh, that's hard, or whatever. I got nicotine sobriety. I know what it's like getting off a hard drug, you know? So I got to share my experience in a context I had no experience. Multiply that times 30 years, okay? There is no circumstance in life that had my name on it that I would shrink from. I had some experiences recently of doing some really challenging, taking some really challenging actions on behalf of suffering, alleviation of suffering. And getting that close to pain and really understanding pain, I can't say that I haven't seen deep, dark pain, anxiety, frustration, despair, all that stuff. And to be able to be present because of my spiritual life, not shrink or like, you know, whatever, to just say yes when my higher power says. And I appreciate so much you all being here. In my wildest dreams, I had a talk that was rambling, and it was just like so good. And this is not so bad. I don't mean that at all. I have my experience, strength, and hope. I am here. I am with my brothers and my sisters. I know everyone here. You know? And I am going to talk about sponsorship real quick. And just by the way, this is my beloved sister-in-law, Jen. July 25th, 2013, she died of cancer. And you know what's coming next. Pictures and words. And I got to do the layout and so on. But anyhow, so when I got sober, people would talk about sponsorship. And finally at 6 months sober, well, when I didn't, my brother-in-law would have been a natural, but he had a big mouth. It would not be possible to talk to him about anything that was going on. And that's just how it was. And I knew from seeing my therapist, this woman friend of mine, the last woman I was in love with, I was in her arms, she was in my arms, and love you so much. And then I'd stopped drinking for about 6 weeks. I started again, it came apart. 3 months later, roughly, her car was washed off the road in a storm. They found the car, they didn't find her. I was totally tore up and brokenhearted. I wanted to die. If I die today, I can be with her forever, that kind of stuff. And 20 months later, my mom stopped by my workshop and said, we noticed you haven't been happy for a while. And would you see this therapist? I saw this therapist the next day, and that was turned out to be my first day sober. And shared my grief. And she asked me to don't drink too. See me next week. Now it's 9 years since I've been sober, except with this precious woman. And I said, sure. And out of the clear blue, I was able to do that. And the next week I saw her, she asked me to read a book called Under the Influence. I said, sure. And don't drink till you see me next week. And I said, sure. And I read that book. And the next week I saw her, we talked about maybe my alcoholism. And she asked me to go to AA. And that's when I called my brother-in-law. He brought me. And I never looked back. But in that book, I learned that alcoholism is a disease. It's progressive. And I have it. There's four stages. I mean, you can break it down however you want. But having a large capacity to drink, using it for emotional response to life. I was definitely there and there, having to have alcohol to function. Okay, well, I didn't have a wife, I didn't have kids, I didn't have a job, I didn't have to function, I could sleep it off. So I always thought I wasn't third stage, but some people are. In fourth stage is wet brain, cirrhosis, and death. And we're definitely not there, but we are 10 seconds from there. So when I got a sponsor at 6 months. I chose someone who seemed like they needed something to do. I didn't choose someone that I wanted what they had. And I kept them for a year. And at the end of the year, we did the first three steps. We didn't go forward. I was ready to kill myself. I quit smoking, gained 50 pounds. Had a nicotine fit. So either smoke, drink, or kill myself. And I knew suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. It's jumping to the ultimate conclusion. That's out. So then it's drink or smoke. And in my mind's eye, I could see a bottle of Jack Daniels on the coffee table. And I knew to drink was to turn my will and my life over to the care of alcohol. So I redid my third step, turn my will and my life over to care of God as I understand God. God sent me immediately to Safeway. I got a pack of Camel Straights. The next day, I thanked my sponsor. I got another sponsor who took me through the steps. And he was my sponsor for the next 10 years. And anyhow, I'm over time, but if you're new, you definitely want to get a sponsor. You want to find someone that has what you want. But I want to emphasize, it's your job to have the right sponsor. It's not your sponsor's job to be the right sponsor. Thank you for the chance to share. I missed that. What's that?
So I'm going to grab my binder, bring it back over to the podium.
Oh, yes.
Sweet hands.
I love you.
I should have put it back.
No. All righty. Okay, one more round of applause for Billy. Thank you.